got a job there in the satellite call center in the middle of a warehouse at Pods. And we started in a call center, like just doing telephone sales, right? Mm-hmm. Helping, you know, selling people these Pods containers that they can move with. And we had 6 minutes to get their MasterCard or Visa.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the GMI Rocket Show. I'm your host, Roman Zelichenko. I am a former immigration attorney turned entrepreneur. I am the co-founder and CEO of Laborless, an immigration tech company that automates H-1B visa compliance, and also the founder of GMI Rocket, which is it's a digital marketing agency focused on the immigration mobility industry, and of course also brings you the show. Today is special for a couple of reasons. Number one, we're at episode 85. It is the final episode of 2022 of the calendar year, because we are in closer to the middle of December. And, you know, for holidays and such, the show will be taking a break for a couple of weeks until January. It's also a really special show because our guest today is somebody who many, many people in the industry know, whose show I've been on, who has made a name for himself across mobility, immigration, relocation, etc. Our guest today is Ben Cross, who is the CEO and founder of Glomo. So Ben, we're going to get into Ben's story, and Ben has been in the mobility industry for a while, and a few years ago launched his own company, Glomo, which is basically a consulting company that supports mobility, immigration, and other companies in the industry on various things, including talent recruitment, business development, and sales, mergers and acquisitions, and other really, really interesting things that are really deeply involved with the immigration and mobility industry. So I'm super excited to talk to Ben about how he grew his brand so much through LinkedIn and through creating a show and content, and how he leveraged that to leave his, you know, prior jobs and build his own company. It's going to be a really fun conversation. I could do a probably an hour-long show introducing Ben, but I think we're all here to have the conversation. So Ben, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it, man. I'm excited for this.
Thank you, Roman. Like, this is awesome. I mean, honestly, I've been a fan of watching your stuff for a long time. Show 85, man. Congratulations.
Yeah. I know you've done, what, 400 episodes now plus?
Yeah. You know, year one, we were really cranking them out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Year two, still cranking them, less so. Year three, yeah. Less so, but I mean, yeah, we're I think over 400. I haven't counted recently, but yeah,
it's unbelievable. Cool. So, and we're gonna talk about Love and Reload, which is your show and everything you're doing. Before we jump into your story, just for folks watching and tuning in live, please give us a shout out. Let us know who you are, where you are tuning in from, where you work, yes. And you know, leave a comment. Obviously, as we go, if you have questions for Ben, my hope is to get, you know, share a little bit of Ben's story that maybe not a lot of people know, because Ben, you're always, you know, interviewing other people. So kind of hopefully the tables are turned a little bit this time. And obviously, if you're enjoying this, please give a like, a love, whatever, a clap. If something's funny, give it a little laugh emoji.
I like, really, if something's funny. There's a very good chance that nothing's going to be funny today, but please bear with us.
No, there's going to be a good chance that a lot is going to be funny for sure. So Ben, okay, I love to get started by learning about people's backgrounds. And, you know, you and I have chatted before. We have a New York connection. Can you share a little bit about, like, so where, because you're also mobile, you've relocated quite a few times too.
Yeah.
Where did your life kind of begin? Where did you sort of grow up, and kind of where did young Ben Cross spend his time?
Yeah, young Ben Cross. A lot of misspent youth, honestly. No, but I was born in Dallas, Texas. I was born in Dallas, but I grew up in New York. I grew up in White Plains, New York, in Westchester County, for those of you who don't know, just north of the city. And I went to school up in Albany, New York, SUNY Albany. Shout out, go Danes. And I have lived since school, moved to back to Dallas, northern suburbs, Plano, you know, then out to Clearwater, Florida, where I, you know, got my first start in corporate America at Pods. Clearwater, Tampa, bounced around there a little bit, came back to Dallas, thought I was going to set down roots there and really start a family, get a house, do the whole deal, right? And then got relocated up to North Carolina, wow, where I worked for 1-800-PACKRAT, and then kind of ran a division, started a company within a company there, and then ended up in Michigan, got recruited up to Michigan, and then came back to Texas. So I'm living in Texas for the fourth time in my life, third time since college. And I really do feel like I'm a product of relocation. I know kind of like your story too. I mean, you're kind of a product of global mobility in a way, and I'm kind of a product of domestic mobility and relocation. But I think that's like the coolest thing when you find people in this business that have kind of done it themselves. It gives you a different perspective.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, to be fair, my family relocated, if you will. We left and moved to the U.S. when I was just two. So I don't remember all that much. But my parents definitely, and the rest of my family who came here a bit before us. But you were born in Texas. I mean, you grew up sort of in New York and went to college in New York, in upstate New York. I like to ask this question because the answer differs and there's no right answer, but did you think ever that you wanted to start a business? Were you sort of a business oriented sort of younger kid? Like, did that ever, or were you sort of more, traditional career path, if you will?
Yeah. So I never knew I wanted to start a business, but I was always selling things. So I didn't realize that these were entrepreneurial traits, but like when I was a kid, I was selling candy, like leftover Halloween candy. I realized if you just wait a month or two, the market would dry up. You could hit people with those Snickers bars and those, fruit by the foots and whatever, and like do pretty well for yourself. I remember, getting fireworks in Pennsylvania, bringing them back to New York, selling fireworks, and then you get to the high school and college, you start selling other things. So I was always selling something, right? And then when I was in college, I actually became a club promoter, right? So I was selling clubs then, or I was selling, coupon books or something to parents when they drop their kids off, 2-for-1 pizzas and stuff like that. So I was always finding a way to sell something to get a little extra money in my pocket. And looking back on it, I was 100% an entrepreneur. In the moment, no, I wasn't my families don't own businesses. You talk to some entrepreneurs like, yeah, my parents owned a store and I'd work in the store or whatever. I don't have that kind of a story. My parents kind of just worked in like jobs, corporate jobs, So I guess I always wanted to be kind of a business person. I always wanted to go to an office and wear a suit and like kind of look important and do all that stuff. Right. But I wouldn't say I dreamed of being a business owner, or entrepreneur. It wasn't until later in life where I started to hear these stories of entrepreneurship and they started to connect with me. And I kind of put a fine point on my dreams and aspirations. I was like, that's who I am. That's what I am, because I never felt at home in any job I worked in. I was always a bit of always had too many ideas. I was always inconveniently raising my hand and offering feedback on processes and to my boss. And I was always, I was a bit of a troublemaker, like that, even in school, right? And then in the workplace too, because entrepreneurs are inconvenient because they don't want to do it the way it's being done. I read a quote one time and I'm going to totally butcher it. Maybe somebody that's watching can like get a link to this or something, but it said something like entrepreneurs are the juvenile delinquents, because they're the ones who say, I'm not going to do it this way anymore. And they kind of get up and they walk away and they go do something else. Mm-hmm. And, in school, we try to teach kids that that's bad behavior, right? You need to sit down, you need to do what you're supposed to do. You need to be quiet. You need to turn your assignments in just like this. You need to follow a structure. And, if you're not doing that as a kid, you're not nonconformity. We try to beat that out of our kids through the system.
Yeah.
And then you get to the real world and you realize that's the trick is being a nonconformist and finding a better way to do it. And if you do what other people do, then you're just going to have those mediocre results. And if you want to be mediocre, that's cool. But if you want to be exceptional and you want to be extraordinary, you have to do extraordinary things,
That's right. That's right. It's sort of one of those things where it makes sense, of course. You have a school, just thinking about education, not that we're going to talk about this, but you have a classroom with 30 students, which we have in New York City. There has to be structure, right? Otherwise, it'll be chaos and no one will learn anything. But you're right. I mean, there is also this other side of it where that mindset is just ingrained in us for many, many, many years, starting from a young age. When you get into the workplace and you feel the same way too. I mean, I also recognize that if you work at a really large company, there also has to be structure. Otherwise, there will be chaos there as well. But I think a healthy balance, you know, sort of is needed. And skepticism of structure is always important.
I also want to bring on one more. Because the school is like the corporation. And now the irony, as I'm over here and like going into year three of our business, we just celebrated our second anniversary this month. And now the irony is, as I spent a whole day in a corporate strategy seminar with these consultants, is that now the irony is, now I am the corporation. So now I'm trying to create the same processes, procedures that I was bucking as an entrepreneur. And now I have to be the one who's in charge and trying to, like, you know, create order and structure, you know? And so, and I'm ill-equipped to do so because I'm like the, you know, so, right. So now of course you have to bring people like Shauna Chesanowski, our director of operations, and Danny Herskowitz, shout out to my team. I have a phenomenal team to bring those people in who can have that structure in those processes. So
exactly. And to me, the thing that I think the truth there is that there's a time and place for both. There's a time and place for disruption and going against the grain, going against the processes that have been developed. And then as that, you know, organization grows, you have to put back some structure. But of course, if you can bake in some amount of flexibility or creativity or whatever into that structure, I think that's, you know, that's sort of the golden rule. I want to ask though one thing, like, because, you know, just to go back a little bit in time once again, I'm curious, when you were, you know, selling candy, selling, you know, club promotion, selling any other things you could sell as sort of as a kid, was it from a perspective of like, just, you know, I want a little extra money in my pocket? Or did you ever find it sort of fun or exhilarating? Or was it ever creative? Like, or maybe you weren't thinking about that. I'm curious.
No, totally. It was the game. It was like, because what's cool about sales specifically is it's a game with points, and they're like points are dollars, you know, and there's a score, you know, and it's not about the attainment of money and wealth, although that has all these other amazing, cool benefits to it. But it's like, I'm winning, you know, like I'm over here and I'm taking a dollar, turning it into two, like that's a really cool process. And then the negotiation and the haggling, you know, and the 2 for 10, you know, and like those kinds of, like, you know, kind of things. I love that. I love all of it.
Me too. Yeah. And I was curious because I think that there is, you know, that mindset is very entrepreneurial in my mind. And I guess now that we're reflecting on it, you know, that makes sense. When you were in that moment, you kind of were just thinking through like the exhilaration of selling something or whatnot. But
yeah, it's like going out of Canal Street, right? And trying to buy a knockoff watch or something like that, you know, and you're trying to, guy wants 15 and you're trying to get it for 12, you know, or whatever. And like, I was exposed to that. Like, even though I was in the suburbs, I was exposed to that kind of at a young age. And the fact that, like, you know, prices aren't fixed, you know, and everything's negotiable. And like those kinds of concepts were ingrained in me, I think, at a young age by my parents, even though they worked in, you know, traditional jobs, they also brought some of that kind of mentality. So I love my upbringing. And in some ways it was really hard, but in some ways it was great because, you know, I had this like Southern heritage, which was like kind of one thing, like kind of this work ethic and kind of this cultural, like kind of different culture thing in Texas, which is also fiercely independent. Like Texas as a state is as fiercely independent and unique and amazing as New York City is as a city. People don't realize that. They think Texas and New York could not be more opposite, but in a lot of ways, they're so similar. I mean, they both have amazing business environments. They have these amazing, strong, you know, pride, right? Mm-hmm. From people like, oh, New York, if you can make it anywhere, you can make it.
Right.
Listen, I'll tell you what, Texas is the same type of thing. I mean, you got people that are going out here, you know, wildcatting for oil, startups like Michael Dell, you know, in Austin. I mean, you got the most kind of the Jerry Joneses of the world. I mean, you got hustlers here and ambitious people who are also fiercely unique and independent. So, you know, I just think it's kind of cool. And I like to bring that up to people, especially people, you know, like on the East Coast or from New York, because they sleep on Texas and they think it's like all cow towns and hay seeds and whatnot. So
yeah, that's a great, I love that. I hadn't heard that comparison yet. I really love that. I wanted to just bring in a couple of, so we have Jana here says, happy Friday, such a special show, proud of you guys. Thank you, Jana, for the shout out, the comment. Jack says, hello, gentlemen, and hello Jack. To you as well, Jack. Josea says, hello, Roman and Belle.
Hosea. I love Hosea. Hey, can I give Hosea a big shout out, man? Because we're talking about like my business and everything and Glomo and all that kind of stuff. Hosea was my first client, my first real full-time client at Glomo. He was
awesome.
The person that first believed in me, and I believe the greatest gift you can give somebody is to believe in them. And the second greatest gift you can give them is startup money. Okay. And he gave me both those things. Okay. So, I mean, he gave me that first check. He gave me that first belief in me. And without him, I wouldn't be here right now. So shout out to Jose. I love that. Love that guy like a brother. He's going to be here next week for our strategy meetings as well.
So that's all. That's awesome. Appreciate you, Jose, as well, just being somebody who supports small companies. We have Tian Yang from Stockholm. So how are you? Also, Jack gave us the quote. If you want to understand the entrepreneur, study the juvenile delinquent. All right. I kind of want to move on a little bit because I think we can talk about sort of philosophy and even your sales thoughts around sales for a long time. But you eventually graduated college, like you said. You kind of moved around. You started your job. You started your career at Pods, which is a fantastic company with its own really incredible story.
Hi.
And you ended up, I guess, were you placed in corporate relocations? I mean, did you know what that was until you got the job there, or was it
Pods was the first place that would hire me. Okay. I didn't like be like, oh, you know, this is a cool startup with a great trajectory and an interesting industry. Like, no, man. Like, I was an English major from SUNY Albany with an Africana studies minor. I'm just like, I'm living with my mom. I got my girlfriend here from Staten Island. And if I don't find a job soon, she's going to leave me and go back to Staten Island. So I needed to get the first job I can get. So we opened up the newspaper. You'll love this. The newspaper, the Help Wanted ads with the highlighter. She found this job at a call center. And I said, well, hey, you know, if they're hiring, like, they're having a job fair, can I go? She's like, no, you can't go. It's my job. Because we were competitive back in the day, too. Still are kind of. And I was like, well, come on. We both need a job. So we both went. We both got the jobs. We were the only people who showed up with suits. Probably the only people with college degrees. It was a mess. Anyway, so we got a job there in the satellite call center in the middle of a warehouse at Pods. And we started in a call center, like, just doing telephone sales, right? Mm-hmm. Helping, you know, selling people these Pods containers that they can move with. And we had 6 minutes to get their MasterCard or Visa. Like, you know, it's like sell or walk, you know? And it's like, you know, you have a talk time, you have conversion rate, you have quality numbers, you got to hit all that stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's when you start learning things like feature bridge, you know, benefits, you start learning things like objections and rebuttals. You start learning things like, you know, product, you know, knowledge and things like that, how to craft that into, you know, probing questions and all, like, all the mechanics of sales. And sales really became, at that point, I was doing it like ad hoc because I liked the game, to your point earlier, and I liked to have a couple of bucks in my pocket. But that's where I really got formalized training and got the opportunity to also get the amount of reps in. You know, when Malcolm Gladwell talks about like 10,000 hours and things like that, right? Like, I got 35 phone calls a day. I got 35 ups, if you will, in the car business, right? A car salesman, right? He's going to work 8 hours. He might get like 10 ups. He might get 10 people walk through the door that he gets a chance to sell, you know, door to door. You know, I look for, you know, if I'm business to business, I might have 70 people in my pipeline in a year, right? Client leads. Well, I'm getting 35 a day, right? And so I'm getting the opportunity to hone and tweak and iterate through the process all the time. So I started writing scripting. I started doing all these things. And that's really where I learned, forget moving and relocation. I mean, that was a few years later, but I started learning how to sell in that job. Then I moved my way up through the ranks to start as a person on the phone. I was like, I have got to get off this telephone. 4 months later, I got promoted to a supervisor role. They actually relocated me. I started in March. They relocated me end of August. So 5 months later, they relocated me to headquarters. I took over a job called the sales champion role there, which was like kind of a ridiculous title, but it was really cool. And then got to run contests, do coaching, things like that. And then I actually took over a team of like 25 inside salespeople working the night shift from 2 to 11:30 at night. And that was interesting because at 24 years old, I was running a team of people who were sometimes twice or more my age. So that was an interesting challenge. And I was like, I got to get out of this call center, right? So I have these epiphany moments where I'm like, A, I got to get off this phone. B, I got to get out of the call center because nobody respected the call center. If you were a call center person, you were just like lowest person in the organization. You know, they thought of you as unskilled labor, essentially, right? And I was like, I've got to get off this call center into the corporate side of the house, you know? And so I finally got an opportunity in the marketing department to come on as a corporate account manager. corporate account manager, oversaw all of the B2B moving. Well, what is B2B moving? Relocation, right? And so that's where I like learned what's an RMC, you know, what's a lump sum policy? How come? And that was about 2010, maybe. Mm-hmm. And that was when I started like learning, okay, there's these conferences and these trade shows. And I remember the first trade show I went to in Orlando was the Keller Williams Family Reunion Show. Blew my mind. And I was like, this is where I want to be. In this trade show booth, talking to all these people, going to all these parties. This is where I want to be. That was an epiphany for me. And then, but I didn't know how to be successful in that environment until there was a senior person that they recruited to come into the organization. Her name was Tina Azzarella. She's not in the business anymore. But Helen Miracle, if you know Helen, she knows Tina. And Tina came in and she was like this, like kind of this graybeard, right? They brought in from outside the organization to come in and kind of like help bring us to market in the relocation space. Because they understood it was kind of an insular community, right? Clickish, whatever. You needed to know how to talk the talk and walk the walk in order to be successful in their business. So they brought Tina in. And I remember I hit it off with Tina. She was like this kind of like, you know, anyway, she had like this shtick and this kind of like vibe, you know? And so I hit it off with Tina and she'd been very successful in relocation. She said, all right, give me your pitch. So I took her in the conference room. I gave her the pitch. I'm going through the slides, you know, I'm giving the features and benefits and hey, it's 4 inches, the container's 4 inches off the ground, which is great because it won't flood and all this ridiculous nonsense that nobody cares about. And I said, all right, Tina, how'd I do? I thought I crushed it. I was like, how'd I do? She's like, meh. I'm like, what do you mean, meh? Like, she's like, meh. I'm like, well, how do you sell? And I remember this, Roman, I remember this, man. This is why I had to change my life. She got up. She's like, this is how I sell. She's like, hey. And she walked up to me and she gave me a big hug. I'm like, what in the hell does that have to do with selling a container that moves people?
Right.
And I didn't realize, like, until that moment, like, it's really like that Dale Carnegie adage, right? People don't care what you know until they know how much you care. And if you're not relating to people and you're not treating them like a person and you're not speaking to the person before the whole company and the product aren't BS and nobody cares about, like, you're missing the boat. So I changed everything about my approach from, like, that moment forward, really.
So what did you do? Like, do you remember what are some of the changes that you
actually started hugging people? I started touching people. To be honest with you, I was in call center management. So I had 300 people on the floor and it was like very HR driven and you're writing people up for 15 minute breaks and like all sorts of ridiculous stuff. And like, you couldn't touch people in the call center. Like you're going to get written up. You're going to get fired. You can't, I mean, this sounds ridiculous and this sounds like stuff we're not supposed to talk about, but you couldn't like put your, like touch somebody on the shoulder or like give somebody a hug. Mm-hmm. Like you don't do that stuff in this environment. And I realized everything I thought I couldn't do was everything I should do. Mm-hmm. Like now I'm giving hugs. Now I'm, you know, talking about people's personal life. Now I'm asking them what they're doing on the weekend. Now I'm like having a beer with my colleagues, like stuff that I was like alcohol in the workplace. You don't mix those things. Mm-hmm. That was a hard and fast rule growing up. Mm-hmm. That's my job now, Roman.
Right.
If I don't have hugs and alcohol, how would I sell anything? Like legitimately, like everything they tell you not to do is everything you're supposed to do.
Right.
So like, I mean, it changed everything, man.
Yeah. Yeah. That's powerful. I'm curious to know, as you took that and internalized it, you know, obviously you moved away and you grew, you got another job after Pods, you moved over to Freight Center and you had a few other positions. And I'm sure we can pull a lot of lessons from all of them. I kind of just want to talk a little bit about that experience growing in the industry overall until we get to your time at University Moving and Storage, because that's where things sort of really started to change for you. But up until that point, did you sort of start to realize that you've unlocked something within the industry? Because you clearly moved up the ranks fairly quickly. You moved from company to company, and now you have this newfound understanding of how to connect with people, both internally on your team to make them feel more productive and just happier, and of course with clients too. So I'm curious, how did you sort of Like, what did you make a decision to say, like, all right, I'm staying in this industry, I'm using this newfound sort of understanding and intuition about how to grow, and I'm going to make an impact within relocation?
Yeah. I mean, I went to my first worldwide ERC conference, I want to say in 2011, maybe 2012. It was in San Antonio. It was the national conference in the spring that they don't have anymore. They got rid of it. They consolidated to one conference. And I remember going there and I was like, yes, this is where I want to be. It's probably like my second, third trade show, something like that. I was like, yes, this is where I want to be, but I don't like how this is going, because everybody knew each other and I didn't know anybody. So you feel like it's all clicky and you're on the outside, right? You're the new kid in high school or something. And I was like, this is great, but we got to change a couple things about this. Like, nobody's talking to me. Nobody knows me. They're treating me like if they don't know me, they don't need to know me, because they know everything. So how do I break into these cliques? Because I know I'm worth knowing. So how do I break into these cliques and become someone who's known? Because I learned also, I was taught, it's not who you know, it's who knows you. So a lot of times, like, you know, you can go into a room and you can like walk into a trade show or something or a conference and be like, I know this. I know these are all this person. They all work here. They all do this. This is the CEO of whatever. But if they don't know who you are, then it doesn't matter. So then it's like, okay, how do you become known, right? So then I started volunteering quite a bit. So I realized early on, A, I love the whole, just the vibe. I love like conference vibes. And I'd probably like just about any industry, but I do think our industry is unique.
Yep.
I think it's unique for a couple of reasons. One, we're in the business of helping people. Not only are we helping people, like social workers help people, but we help people find like opportunity, mm-hmm. right? Like global mobility is upward mobility, right? We help people move around the world to find the best possible opportunity and find their purpose and self-actualize.
Yeah.
Is that a word?
Yeah.
Self-actualize. You know, and not only for them, but for their kids, like your parents did for you, you know, and now, right. you know, you went and got a law degree and did all these things, now you're an entrepreneur, like all these amazing things that may or may not have ever happened, right? And so the ripple effects of what we do for people are massive, right? So there's great purpose. There's great humanity there. And I think that's one thing that was like, it creates, that I was drawn to, but it creates this environment where people are hugging all the time, where people mm-hmm. are genuinely friends, right? Where people do care about, even competitors are coming together and caring about one another yeah. and breaking bread together. And I think that, it's super interesting. It's super unique. And it was actually I was having dinner with Lynn Shotwell, one night, and I was like, you know, you've worked in different industries. She's the president of Worldwide ERC. I'm like, you've worked in other industries. Are we different? She's like, yeah, y'all are different. It's a lot of industries, you know, they come together, they, you know, minor hugs, side hugs, you know, whatever, glass of wine. But like, y'all like love each other. Like y'all go to each other's house for like Christmas parties and holiday parties. And like y'all support each other's kids. And like, y'all are different, you know? And I was like, cool, that makes me feel normal, because I thought we were different. So, yeah, so I mean, I knew this is where I wanted to be. I knew I had to do something huge and impactful if I was going to be who I wanted to be, where I wanted to be. So I knew that was where I wanted to be. I just didn't quite know yet how to become the person, how to go from knowing who everybody was to them knowing who I was.
I think that's the perfect opportunity for a show like Love and Relo, right? So let's talk a little bit about that, because that obviously started as something that you were doing kind of while you were still working. You weren't doing this on your own while you were still working. So what's the story? Like, what moved you? Because I think from the perspective of onlookers, you just popped up one day on YouTube, on LinkedIn, said, hey, I'm starting a show. But something moved you to say, this is the avenue I want to take to connect with people, share their stories to get known. So what was the crux of the idea for what became Love and Relo?
The whole idea was, I'm having these phenomenal, transformational, life-changing experiences, or that's how it feels to me, that's my truth, at these conferences, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the feeling of, I'm sure you feel it too, the magic of in-person, having a glass of wine, maybe three, and solving the world's problems.
Right.
Hugs, just loving each other, thinking about new ideas, sharing, becoming validated, all these things, listening to the smartest people in our industry on panels talking about stuff. I'm like, this is amazing. And then I go home, I go back to the office, and Susie in accounts receivable didn't have that transformational experience. You know, and I'm over here like on fire. I'm just like, oh, you wouldn't believe it. This happened and this happened. It was incredible. And these people were talking about this stuff. And oh my gosh. And people were looking at me like I had two heads, like they didn't get it, right? And I'm realizing 99.9% of this industry will never have that experience.
Right.
We don't realize how privileged we are when our company decides to invest thousands of dollars to send us to the International Association of Movers Conference or Worldwide ERC or URA or whatever. And I felt like I had almost an obligation. Like, I care about people deeply. I felt like I had almost an obligation to bring that back home, right? So that the person in the cubicle gets that experience, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, I want to share this with people. And I also felt like I had a lot to say. I'm not going to lie. Like, mm-hmm. I felt like I had a lot to say. And I would sit on panels a lot. I mean, best case scenario, you might get on like two panels a year and get mm-hmm. to share your thoughts. I was like, I got way more to say than that.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I don't want to, you get on a panel, there's five of you, you get your like 5 minutes, you know, and half of it's groupthink. And you're just like, yeah, I agree with Susie. You know? And I got a lot to say. I got a lot of stuff that they won't even let me say on these panels. There's a lot of voices out here that aren't getting elevated, you know, and I'm like, I want to solve all that, you know? Mm-hmm. And the internet now, I mean, everybody's got a microphone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want a platform, you can have a platform. If you wanted to have a show 50 years ago, you'd have to go try out at NBC and then tell you you're not good enough, whatever, and they wouldn't pick your show up, you know?
Right.
Or you'd have to get on AM radio, or maybe in the 80s you get on, you know, cable access. You know what I mean? But now we can talk to anybody, anywhere, anytime for like nothing. So it's like at that point, you know, you got to look yourself in the mirror and say, okay, am I willing to do, like, I want all these things, but am I willing to do what it takes to get these things? And so I did.
So, I mean, that's unbelievable. I obviously completely agree with you in terms of being able to share our voices.
Amazing, dude. Like, you make inspiration for me, honestly, Roman.
Thank you. Yeah, and look, the reality is people also spend a lot of their time online. And so, you know, it's like the attention is there. They're not getting these same experiences that we're getting going to conferences. And so really bridging that gap is easier than people might think. So,
yes.
You know, so for you, the decision was to start a show called Love and Reload. I think I understand where the name Love and Reload comes from, because so far, I think our conversation has just shown that, A, you love the industry and the people, and obviously this is all about relocation. You started to bring on, or did you bring on guests from the beginning? Was that?
So check it out. So I learned really quick. Like, that's the thing with like reps, right? With iteration and reps, is you learn really quick what works and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. And you're going to learn infinitely more by doing than you're going to learn by philosophizing about something, right?
Agreed.
So basically, I'm going to give you like the real quick genesis of what happened, right?
Please.
So as you know, LinkedIn, because I know a lot of your followers and stuff are kind of into LinkedIn marketing, into branding, things like that. So I'll make real quick. So LinkedIn first started short form posts. Then they went to like, you could put a picture on there. Then they went to, you could put a, you know, like video clip from YouTube on there. Then they went to native video, which means you could upload a clip yourself, right? And then they enabled live. LinkedIn Live. And they did this in second half of 2019. They did it for only beta user groups, right? Like a small group. And you had to ask permission. And so I applied. I started seeing this going on. And I was like, recognized instantly, this is gonna be mega, right? So much organic reach on LinkedIn. I was like, this is gonna be mega. If I can be the first person to start doing this in our industry, it's gonna be mega. So I applied for it and I got denied. And then I applied for it again and I got denied. And then I applied for it and I was like, I'm not accepting no. I was like, I have something to say. I'm awesome. This is going to happen. It's going to happen. So I started to tag the guy. I found the guy who's in charge of approving these things. It took some research, but there's like this one dude and he's like a hermit. He's not even like a big face guy. He's like a like a hermit guy in a cubicle there who's like in charge of this beta program, whatever. Found this guy. He had 200 followers. I'm like, I started tagging him on all my posts. I started tweeting him. I started being like, yo, bro, this is where it's at. This is the content. Like everybody let, I forget his name, Bob know that I need to have a live channel. Like I stalked this guy, like legit, I did. And finally I was at a Halloween party, 2019, with my kids. I looked at my phone, I had the red dot. And on your profile was, if you had the red dot, you could go live. Mm-hmm. I was like, I got the red dot. I thought I was like drunk. I was like, I got a red dot. So I had the red dot, and that was October 31st, 2019. Remember these days, like days your life change. And I was like, I got to do something with this. And what I do? 2 months went by. I got to do something. But you don't know what to do, right? How many of us live in that moment? I got to do something, but then you don't do it. All of the analysis, paralysis, whatever, right? I was like, I got to do something. And I met this kid, Terrell. And Terrell was like this kid who was like 19 years old, living with his mom in Detroit. I met him at a coffee shop outside of Wayne State University. Kid had like no polish, no knowledge, but had so much charisma. And you're just like, he's got the it thing, right? So me and Terrell were talking, and we developed this relationship, and I was coaching him. And then he was challenging me. He's like, okay, Ben, you say you're so great and whatever, this and that. Make a video, go live, do it. You say you want to do it, go do it, right? He was like, he was being aggressive. And I was like, he's like, go do it then, whatever. And so he became my accountability partner. This kid, he didn't even have a car. He didn't even have his own place, didn't even have a job. Like, he became my accountability partner. So he would text me every morning. We would text each other and be like, yo, are you making a video? Yo, you gonna do this? And so he was the one that pushed me actually to hit the button. So January 1st of 2020, might be like January 3rd or something. It's like first day back in the office. Mm-hmm. I went live for the first time and I did Love and Reload. And it was just me and a camera. And I was like, okay, here it is, January of 2020. What are the next 10 years of relocation going to be like? And I'm just going to man in a camera, tell you what the next 10 years are going to be like. And it was so bad. It was so bad. I mean, the ideas might have been all right. I don't know. I haven't watched it in forever because it's so cringy, right? But like the lighting was trash. Like I'm just sitting there like in my chair. Like I got no posture. It was like bad. It was the camera was bad. And I'm like, okay. And I did 40-minute monologue, which you might say, okay, I can see that. But I did 40-minute monologue. And at the end, I'm like, whew. I was like, two things. I thought that was really hard, but I need to do it again. And I can't do it alone. I can't just talk to the camera. I can't. I need to bring somebody else in on this. And so I started bringing other people in, and I brought in, I think my second guest was Alex Alpert, CEO of Shift. I mean, right? Things have changed, huh? Third guest was Adam Lowy from Move for Hunger. Fourth guest might have been Rachel, who's now does our marketing and Next Destination. And so on. Chuck White might have been like number five. And I started doing these guests like that, and that's how it came in. I'll stop. But the last thing I'll say is about that is, and then somebody said to me about 3 weeks in, doing it every day for 3 weeks, 15 episodes, if you will. They said, this is really cool and everything, but how come you only have white men on this show? And I was like, oh man. I was like, that's not who I want to be. That's not me. That's not what I'm about. And I look back on it and I was like, well, you know, I got Ray DeSilva, I got Chuck White, I got Rachel, but 12 out of 15, yeah, white men, right? And I was like, okay, I need to fix that. So I started trying to be more intentionally diverse, right? And then people were like, how come you just have people from the US on?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've never been anywhere else. So, and then I was like, what do you suggest? And then we ended up having LATAM week, and we had Africa week, and we did some stuff with Asia. And we had, Pride Month, and we had a Black History Month. Like, we started doing all these things. And, like, there'd never been a Pride panel at Worldwide ERC.
Right.
There'd never been an Africa panel. But, like, these voices are relevant. They deserve to be heard. They're part of the fabric of what we do. Like, we say we're inclusive. We say we support, but we don't make spaces. So I'm like, I can do whatever I want. So I didn't.
That's such a powerful lesson of, number one, just going for it, turning it on and learning. Number two, kind of taking feedback from people, even if it's critical and might hurt at first, because it's true. It's a truth.
Oh, it totally hurts.
Right? But taking that and saying, okay, I'll sit with this, I'll live with it for a little bit, and then I have to think about how to move forward from here. And the realization, which is, this is, I think, the third and probably most important takeaway for me from that, is the realization that you actually just, you don't have to ask for permission to make that change. You can just do it. You know, you had the podcast and you said, tomorrow I'm going to invite a new type of person. Next week is going to be Latam week. You just decide to do it because you recognize that there's a need for it, there's a demand for it, that it's the right thing to do. Whatever your reasoning, you can just do it. And I love that. And I feel like, you know, I wonder now, thinking back, you know, you just sold naturally as a kid, and you sort of got the reps in and learned more about the sort of how to operationalize sales. And you claim that you were not entrepreneurial, but being entrepreneurial does require some sense of, like, I can just do this. So what's cool is it feels like Love and Relo was kind of your first soft launch of your own enterprise, of your own business. That's where you didn't just sell, because you had to sell. You had to get guests. You have to sell your show. You had to get listeners. You have to sell kind of the content. But you made strategic decisions. You made creative decisions. You made sort of quote-unquote business decisions. Do you ever think about the fact that Love and Relo sort of was your practice ground for being an entrepreneur and getting the feeling of just deciding and moving forward?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, right? And it does allow you, it did allow me to play with entrepreneurship with zero capital, without the pressure of needing revenue, right? I mean, it's easier to sell something when it's free, right? I'm not actually asking for anything. I mean, I'm like, just give me a like. Right. Like, that was our currency, right? That is our currency, right?
And maybe the guest time, right? You ask the guest for a little bit of their time.
But I mean, how much are people really giving us, right? Is Jack Jampel still watching? Probably not. You know, they come in for 15 seconds, hit you with a like, give you a comment. Maybe Jack is. I don't know. I love Jack. My dad does this all the time. We'll come in, hit a comment, make it sound like he's watching, hit a like, and then bounce, you know?
Yeah.
It's fine. It's cool, Dad. I love you. So people, I mean, whether they give us 15 seconds, 30 seconds, a few minutes, who knows? I think so. I'll tell you this about that. Yes, it gave me kind of like that practice run. But it, you know, I'll tell you this. I would not have Glomo without Love and Relo.
Right.
People ask me all the time, this Love and Relo thing, man, that's a lot of time. It's a big time commitment. And people are so ridiculous. Like, that's a big time commitment. What's the ROI on that time? Right. I love when people like who don't know anything try to like sound smart, like tell you what to do. And they're like, that's a big time commitment. What's the ROI on that time? And I'm like, I don't know, like $0. Like, I don't charge people. I don't have sponsors. I don't, you know, whatever. Why do you do it then? You know, it's like, I got this other business over here that does $1 million a year because I did this free podcast. But people don't realize like that, how that works. You know, it's like, what's the ROI of volunteering on a board, or, you know, being on a committee or doing charity work? Or people are so ridiculous. So there's that. And then the other funny thing is another thing that people don't know, that I'll say on your show, is that when I started Love and Relo, because I worked for people like that I was just imitating, I did it. I was in the office. I was working for someone else. I was in an office, and they didn't know I was doing it. They didn't know I was doing it. This is like kind of the funniest part. They didn't know I was doing it. And I would every day at 3:45 Eastern, I would like close my door. I was an executive, so I had an office, so that was cool. So I would close my door. I would lock the door. I would turn off the lights. I would turn on my studio lights. I would put my laptop on top of two 1.5 boxes, book boxes for the layman out there. And I would, you know, set it up. You can go back to the early days, look at it, my setup. And I would broadcast live there, and they had no idea I was doing it. Occasionally my boss would like walk by, try the door, whatever, you know, just like, no, I'm going to call, you know, whatever. And because I knew that they wouldn't like it. They wouldn't understand it. They wouldn't like it. Or if they did understand it and they did like it, then they would want to own it, and they would want to, make it the university moving show, or they'd want to, you know, do these overt plugs or whatever. And I didn't want to muddy the message, you know, or not be able to do Pride Month or something because they wanted to make it the University Moving Swords show, you know? And so what I ended up having to do is I blocked everybody. I blocked everybody at my company on LinkedIn so they didn't know that I was doing it. So I'm out here crushing it, right? Doing the only thing, because it's pre-COVID even, doing the only thing that anybody's doing out there. People would come up to them and be like, hey, you know, Ben's really doing a great job on LinkedIn. Really love what he's doing. It's really so cool, you know? And like, oh, yeah, thanks. Yo, yeah, we're super proud of him, you know? Yeah. But they had no idea because they couldn't see it because it was totally invisible. If you block people, they can't see your content. So it was really crazy. And they didn't realize until August, which is 8 months in, when I actually interviewed the CEO. She's, yes, when I interviewed her, that was the first time they really realized how big it was, because she started getting all this like fan mail and stuff from it. And she was like, from people like in her generation, she was like, I don't normally watch Ben's stuff, but I saw you were on and you were just great. And, you know, that kind of stuff. And she was like, wow, this is really big. Wow. We should, you know, we should have a meeting about this. We should talk about what we could do. And I was like, this is why I wasn't bringing y'all in on this
thing. Right. Yeah.
But I already knew, like, I was probably out. So.
And it also makes sense because this came out of a need or a desire, you know, from you to educate the industry, to connect people with each other, to like spread a message. And anytime.
Rome, you there?
Hey, Ben, you there?
Yep, I got you.
Hey, nice. A little technical difficulty here. I think
I got a great story.
So, but I was going to say that, you know, it makes total sense that, you know, bringing in any sort of money, whether it's one sponsorship or one plug that doesn't feel like it's natural, can really upset people, or at least let the, you know, it gets them to start thinking, huh, what's really the purpose of this show? Is it really to educate me, or is it just to hook me in and then eventually sell me something? So
exactly.
I totally get it. I mean, look, I just as a parallel to it, I also was rejected from LinkedIn Live a number of times. I had to reapply. And then I got it in and I started this show. And I have had people approach me to sponsor episodes and things like that. And I've thought about it, of course. I'm
you got to think about it.
Of course. But you know, the idea for me was always, I don't want that to influence who's going to be my guest, what I'm allowed to say. I want this to be purely informational.
But you have integrity too.
So I know exactly what you mean. And I feel like, you know, for the naysayers who expect an ROI immediately on every single action, I challenge them to take a step back and look at this and how it plays in with other things that you or I or whoever might be doing. To your point, you leverage this and all the value you put out into the world. I really believe, I'm sure you feel the same way, that like, if you put effort and energy out into the world, it will come back to you. It absolutely will. It might come back to you very differently, much later, et cetera, but it has to. Like, it almost like through physics, it has to, because you put the energy out there and it lives, and then it has to come back to you eventually. And it'll come back once it makes its way through other people, other institutions, and it comes back to you in a way that will be hopefully beneficial to you, or at least, you know, positive in some way. So I really do believe that. I want to ask you, because I know we're running up on time, you know, you clearly, you know, you went through this transformation, if you will, of, you know, going from just being a sales guy, you know, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but you weren't connected to the industry emotionally, becoming connected to the industry emotionally, learning that tapping into that emotion actually is a sales tactic, the hugs, the, you know, the love, et cetera. And then you created the show, which was, again, I argue your first like major, it looks like major kind of entrepreneurial endeavor. And then obviously through that, that's where you started to really put out all the good, all the energy that you have. You just said that you were kind of already thinking, you know, number of months into it, of leaving, I guess, and starting your own thing. I want to talk about Glomo before we go, because that's your business, that's a growing business, and you're filling a need within the industry. Talk to me a little bit about how Glomo got started and what the company does today.
Yeah, I mean, Glomo's iterated probably three times in the last 2 years, and it started because I was like naturally helping people. I believe your purpose lies at the intersection of what you love to do and what people will pay you to do. right? And you need to like find that intersection and live there. That's where you need to live. And for me, what I loved doing was helping people grow, helping people make money, helping people develop their business. Like I was I'm a biz dev person because I do love to do it. And I'm a natural connector and I like to connect good people. I always tell people I like to connect good people. That's like my my thing. That's my jam. So I'm over here naturally connecting buyers. Like an RMC needs a mover or a immigration a firm or a corporate housing company or whatever. I'm naturally making those connections like, hey, Bob, meet Sue, you know, y'all are great. Do it, you know? And then so I'm doing that naturally. And especially with my reach, relevancy, and relationships, people are coming to me and asking me for recommendations and things like that. So I'm naturally doing that when I first started Love and Relo. And it started to really be impactful for some of these people I was making introductions to. And so I wasn't asking them for money, but they were like sending me checks to my. Wow. And I'm like, it wasn't quit your job money, but it was like significant, you know, thousands of dollar checks. And so that happened. And then COVID happened and everybody that was doing in-person events like IAM or Alta Vita wants to do a client engagement event or whatever, they couldn't do anything in person. And so I was the one doing everything online. Like I was the guy for, you know, online stuff that didn't suck basically. And so they came to me to like host a conference for them. I remember, you know, you did your virtual conference during that time. Right. And so I started hosting conferences for people, started making a little more money. And so by the end of the first year, you know, I made like $54,000 just off like side hustle, little like stuff, you know? And I realized at that point, okay, there's a business model here. Now, again, 54 grand wasn't going to replace my, you know, $200,000 basically salary that I was making before, right? But I was like, there's people willing to pay you. And like, as soon as somebody's willing to pay you, you have a business model. Then you just have to tweak your rate and, you know, pricing and, you know, other stuff like that and offerings and things like that. So at that point, I said, okay, let me go to my two clients that are basically like the most committed to me and say, if I quit my job today, would you pay me half of what I'm making? Would you pay me half of what I'm making? And they were both like, yeah. And I was like, done. So I knew the floor was what I was making now. Mm-hmm. And I knew if I get two more clients each, you know, paying me 10K a month or whatever, then boom, I could double, right? And the upside is double what I was making.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that sounds pretty sweet. And I could live in my purpose. I could be who I am, you know, all the things, right, that people want. And so that's how it started. And then it's since pivoted out of like events, online events, into consulting, like I just kind of described, and then pivoted again when we brought Danny Herskowitz on last September and we started our talent business, right? Our recruitment business. And that like blew everything up because it was just another natural pivot for a company to, and I hate to say the word pivot because we didn't abandon what we do. I mean, we still do the IAM conference and other events. We still do consulting and have a nice stable of amazing clients that's growing and evolving and just, I mean, really beautiful stuff. But now we have this talent business, which is now the biggest piece of our business. And we're probably going to place almost maybe 60 people this year.
Wow.
You know, year one doing it.
Yeah.
You know, probably going to do, you know, $750,000 in business in that talent space. We've got three recruiters dedicated to it. We're gonna probably double that staff or next year, you know, maybe more. We're probably gonna double. If we got six people now at Glomo right now, we're gonna probably double to 12 next year. Probably gonna double our revenue again to, you know, 2 million next year. That's kind of our goals. That's what we're talking about next week in our strategy meeting. So that's kind of what we're trying to do. And, you know, we hired a video production manager also, Adam Sotelo. And that's why the camera's so crispy and the background so clean, you know, because we're up in the game there, you know. And so we're doing video, professionally produced videos for companies in the space, helping them tell their story, because storytelling was a huge gap in the market we saw. So, you know, we try to fill gaps, right? So people need business development in strategy consulting, boom, we're there for them. If people need to recruit top talent, whether it be relocation consultants, you know, immigration, business immigration associates, or top sales talent, strategic level hires, whatever, we do it all there. Or if people need, video, I mean, we're there for them. So we just try to fill little gaps that are underserved where we think we do a particularly nice job and we have a competency that we can bring to the table.
I love that because to me, this is the beauty of kind of going off on your own and pursuing the things that you know need to be, like the gaps that need to be filled. I think that's incredible. And by the way, congrats. I mean, really, congrats on the growth you guys have been feeling so far. Ben, I know we have to end here, and man, there's so much more for us to.
Yeah, man, we're just getting started, man.
yeah, we're just getting started. But I think to me, what was really interesting, and I would love to have you back on the show, and maybe then we could.
I gotta have you on too, man.
That's right.
For the laws.
This is the beauty, right? We can sort of continue to share. We both love this. We both love to share kind of, our thoughts, our ideas based on what we're hearing and seeing and working on. So I want to kind of end with maybe a question for you in terms of if you would, you've been doing virtual events, you've been doing in-person events. I've felt that there's been a huge resurgence of in-person events. I mean, you guys have been flying all over the world now to attend.
Yeah.
And you started Glomo as basically an events kind of consultancy, right?
I mean, right.
You were working on. Where do you, I'm just as a kind of a question, maybe this can lead into part two, but where, do you think that virtual events are here to stay at all? Or do you really feel that people are like, okay, that was a blip in the radar during the height of COVID. Now we're back and we do want to only be in person.
I think virtual events are going to take the place of webinars. I think that old webinar thing is going to go away and people are just going to host these virtual events with just a much higher production quality and look to engage with their audience in a better way. I do not think in-person events are going away. I can't, we don't know things. We just feel them sometimes. I can't tell you mathematically why, but I know what I know. And I know that when I go to the UK last week for the IBA immigration conference, or if I go to, the IAM conference or Eura over in Sevilla this year, there's just nothing like the trust that's built when you're in person. You're shaking hands with somebody, having a beverage, sharing a joke, just trusting with somebody and seeing just who they are. And I think as long as that is unrivaled in trust building, and as long as business is based on trust, which I think these things are immutable facts, then there'll always be places for in-person conferences.
Yeah, amen. I agree with that too. And Ben, I'm really looking forward to seeing you we're gonna have to see each other at some international conference in 2023.
I can't wait.
Yeah, it's gonna be a lot of fun. Ben, thank you so much. This has been really, really wonderful. So much insight and some inspiration as well. And thank you for sharing your story and sort of taking us on the journey. And I really hope to have you back on the show, man. Really.
It's been a blessing and an honor, Roman, to be here with you finally. And can't wait to do it again. And I can't wait to see you, buddy.
Yeah, you too, man. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thanks.
Thank you all so much for being here. Thank you all for the comments. Thank you all for your love and support. And of course, this is the last episode for 2022, but we'll be back with some amazing guests in 2023. And in the meantime, have a great weekend, everyone. Of course, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. I'm sorry, Thanksgiving. Wow. Have a wonderful holiday, end of year holidays, whatever it is that you celebrate. If you celebrate anything, great new year, and see you in 2023, y'all. Take care.